Welcome back. We're here at the Real Estate Roundtable with IPRG. It's been a little while, so good to see you guys. We have a guest here today, Alex Fotopoulos. Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Thank you for having me.
You're at the law firm Corcomellis and Fotopoulos.
You got it.
All right, perfect.
You got it.
You guys are real estate lawyers.
Nice.
And you specialize in landlord representation with an emphasis on regulation and rent regulatory and DHCR issues. So we're happy to have you here.
Thank you.
Also joined by Justin Zajcek here at IPRG. Mm-hmm. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And Luke Sproviero.
Yep.
This is Derek Besterick. So how are we doing, guys? What's going on?
Doing well.
Good. Nice. Yeah. All right, Alex. So we wanted to have you in. The DHCR just announced that it approved these amendments to the rent stabilization code.
That's right. They're going to be adopted on November 8th of this year. So the idea is hopefully it will only be a prospective application of the amendments after that date.
Okay. So this stuff goes into effect after that date.
Correct.
So as of today, it's not in effect, but it's going to be in like a week or so.
That is exactly right.
All right. So we were talking before we started recording that we didn't really see this like happening. We didn't see this being approved. It kind of came out of left field for us. And we just wanted to talk about, I guess we were paying more attention to the Senate bill that's on the governor's desk. And I guess we wanted to talk about the similarities between these two bills, the differences, what they mean, how it's going to impact the market.
Sure. So just give a little bit of background. The DHCR amendments were initially proposed back in August of 2022. They went through a period of notice and comment, which I believe ended in November of last year. And the DHCR had 1 year from November, I think it was 15th of 2022, to actually adopt them. The DHCR, the governor's office, essentially went radio silent on them until last week, when the DHCR published a notice saying that they were going to adopt these amendments as of November 8th. In the interim, as you just pointed out, the state legislature passed two bills, I think in the special session in June of this year, one of which is essentially encompassed by what the amendments are going to do, and the other one, which would have had a devastating effect, I think, on rent overcharges and calculation of rent overcharges. So I guess I'll just go through a little bit of what the amendments are going to be, and I'll talk about what the key differences are between the legislation. Does that sound good?
Yes, that sounds good.
Okay. And if you guys have questions, just
maybe we can go category by category real quick.
Real quick. Obviously, I know the Senate bill, but the one that was just approved, like who came up with this? It was DHCR?
It's DHCR.
Okay.
You know, there's a question as to who actually wrote the amendments themselves because they're very tenant-friendly amendments. You know, there's very little that's good in there for landlords. So, you know, the idea is that they were written by staff at DHCR and that they took the public's input. But what's interesting is despite the fact that many of the trade groups, RSA and CHIP, testified at the hearing, or at the hearings rather, DHCR made no significant changes to the amendments based on the public's input. So they basically took their initial amendments and said, this is what you're getting. It's going to have some pretty serious consequences, I think, for landlords.
Are they out of line by doing this? Is this their position in life to create new laws, or are they here to enforce laws?
I'm a little confused. Yeah, I think what we're all confused about is we always viewed DHCR as a government agency, which essentially they are, right? They're a government agency.
Sure.
They don't make policy. They protect policy. They you know, so we always thought the policymakers are the ones that create these laws, and then they enforce these laws. So that's where, like, I think the biggest confusion from us, and I think a lot of the other real estate community is. So if you can explain that a little bit further, I think that would be great.
Sure. So I'll try not to bore you with a legal lesson, but there are statutes and then there are regulations. So the legislature passes laws. So the rent stabilization law, the Emergency Tenant Protection Act, those are all laws. The DHCR then enacts or adopts regulations, the Rent Stabilization Code, to which is the DHCR's interpretation of those laws. The DHCR's regulations, the Rent Stabilization Code, cannot go further than the law, the statute, allows it to go. And I think that what's happening in some of these amendments is that the DHCR may be exceeding the authority allotted to it by the state legislature. You know, there's a lot. You see the Supreme Court of the United States actually taking up this issue. You hear, I don't know if you've heard about these cases challenging the EPA's authority to institute regulations, but it's the same idea of what's called delegation. Can the legislature delegate its authority to a state agency to actually enforce the law? And under what parameters can that be done? Here, it looks like the DHCR may be overstepping some of its authority, but I think the flip side of that is the legislature may be even more extreme than the DHCR is at this point. You know, you have factions of the state legislature, which are just so far to the left that you would probably end up worse off if the state legislature, you know, if the state legislature got its way. So, okay. But to make a long story short, the DHCR is supposed to enforce the laws that the legislature passes. That's the long and the short of it.
Got it. So it's very confusing. It's just like, you know, you just don't know who's making the rules and who's really enforcing them.
Well, I think that you'll hear from a lot of people in the legal industry that practice this is that, you know, depending on which judge you're before or which rent administrator you're before and, you know, what time of the day it is, you'll get a different result, you know, every time. So there is not a lot of, I think, clarity in the law, and it's up for a lot of interpretation even right now. And it's unfortunate because, you know, you're talking about very valuable assets and you're talking about making investments, millions of dollar investments with very little clarity.
Yeah, it's a big issue. The lack of clarity is creating a lot of problems in the market, and just the uncertainty and the amount of work that it takes in order to get clarity on what you can do with these assets and what the legal rents are and what the exposure is. It's a big thing, and I'm sure we can touch on that more as the conversation progresses. But let's go through the amendments that they made to the code.
Sure.
So I have on my list here, and this could be completely, there might be more to it, but it starts with sub-rehab, substantial rehabilitation. Then I guess they eliminate the demolition.
They make demolition much harder. They make demolishing buildings much harder.
Okay. And then it's the elimination of the first rent rule upon combination creation. Okay.
That's the big one.
Are those the three or is there more?
There are some other provisions in there. There are going to be some changes to how overcharges are calculated.
Okay.
There's an elimination of the safe harbor against the default formula if you buy in the context of a foreclosure sale. Landlords are now going to be obligated to add domestic partners to leases rather than just spouses. And one of the other major changes is that the person's ability to succeed to a rent-stabilized tenancy is now made much simpler. So children can succeed to their parents in a much more easy fashion than they could before these amendments go into effect.
If it's okay, we'd like to go through these topics one by one.
Sure.
So starting with sub-rehab, it says here on my sheet, they're making it a more onerous process. They've removed the provision where the presumption that a building is in a substandard condition if it's 80% vacant.
That's right.
And I'd like some clarification around this. It used to be that you had to replace 75% of the building-wide systems.
Now it's at least 75%.
Is that what it is?
Now it's at least 75%. And you know, what does that mean? Does that mean in some cases it's 80%, in some cases it's 100%, okay, in some cases it's only 75%?
So let's go through, under sub-rehab, let's go through bullet number one. So that's the presumption that it was in a substandard condition, right, is now eliminated.
And that's completely gray area.
So it used to be that if it was 80% vacant, it was assumed to be in a substandard condition, automatically eligible for substantial rehabilitation if you did the required work.
I agree with just about everything you said,
sure,
except that it was a rebuttable presumption. So mm-hmm, if at some point in time a landlord got challenged, they would have to, and a tenant or somebody said, you know, hey, look, the building wasn't in fact in substandard condition just because it was 80% vacant, they would be able to, the tenant would be able to rebut that presumption. But generally what you're saying is true.
Okay.
Now, even before the amendments go into effect, or even on November 8th, there were, I think, two or three cases that were decided between the spring and the fall of this year, where the DHCR held that in order to be in substandard condition, the building has to be essentially uninhabitable. That, in my view, is wrong on the law, because the law is very clear, says substandard or seriously deteriorated. I think any logical person would think that there's a difference between substandard and uninhabitable. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just, you can for look sure at the dictionary,
yeah,
for that.
Absolutely.
And then they also went a step further. And the decisions, there are two decisions in particular, that held that where a landlord buys out a rent-stabilized tenant, that vacancy can't be counted towards the 80% vacancy threshold. And the thinking was that the apartment was habitable because you're paying money to get the apartment back. It's a sea change in the way that the DHCR processed or interpreted the law. And I think it puts a lot of landlords in a difficult position because they were relying on the 80% threshold. Now, with that being said, I always tried to make sure, and I always try to make sure that the building actually was in substandard condition. So how do you show that? Photographs, an architect's affidavit based on an inspection, HPD violations, DOB violations. But if you're trying to prove uninhabitability, that's a very high bar to meet.
So which one is it?
Well, that's,
can I back up?
That goes to the gray area, the lack of clarity, right? There, I suppose if you follow these two cases, it's uninhabitability, which means that very few buildings in New York, at least today, would be candidates for substantial rehabilitation. Right.
And
absolutely. I mean, I think we've all been doing this for over a decade, and to call something uninhabitable, I mean, I've seen people live in really, really garbage apartments, but inhabitability is something I haven't really seen.
But going back, you said something interesting. So you said if someone buys a tenant out, they don't count that towards the 80%. Is that written down anywhere?
Nope.
So why are we talking about that out of curiosity?
Because that goes back to what we discussed.
Habitability.
Well, it goes back to habitability, but it also goes back to the question of the DHCR's interpretation of the law. The law says substandard or seriously deteriorated. So the question becomes, is the DHCR's interpretation that a buyout means that an apartment is not in substandard or uninhabitable condition,
yeah,
does that exceed its statutory authority? Does it exceed its authority under the law? And I think it does. I believe that at least one of the cases that I mentioned there is being appealed to Supreme Court. And hopefully it will be overturned. But this is going to be a non-issue. I mean, the 80% vacancy is going to be a non-issue come November 8th, because what the DHCR is now telling us is, forget how vacant your building is. You need to be in substandard or seriously deteriorated condition. The question is, what does that mean?
Yeah.
And if you don't have the presumption of substandard condition based on the vacancy anymore, the question becomes, is anybody going to want to invest millions of dollars only to be told after they've done it that you didn't qualify in the first instance because the building was not in substandard or seriously deteriorated.
What about these people that are already doing the work or already completed the work based on the presumption of
the last law?
The last law, but they haven't filed the application and they don't have approval at this time.
But they have permits. They have all pictures. They're almost done.
No, they don't have pre-construction photos. They have during construction photos.
So there's
no proof that it was in a substandard condition. They're relying on the presumption.
That's a tough one. It's not good for that guy.
It's not good for that.
There's a lot of people in that boat.
I know, but...
I think that...
There are.
I know. I believe you.
I think that probably anyone who started a project in the last couple of years and doesn't have pictures is going to be in some trouble.
Pre-construction?
Pre-construction. And I would imagine that if that person had consulted a lawyer, any lawyer that works in this field, you know, the lawyer would have told him, get photographs, get an affidavit from an architect or an engineer attesting to the condition of the building. But in your specific, you know, to your specific question, that person is going to be in some trouble.
I mean, the photos pre-construction, people were doing that in 2015. I mean that, but getting someone through the building and saying, hey, how's this building? What's the condition report? A lot of people didn't do that. Like getting an architect's opinion, people didn't do that.
I think a lot of people thought too, like these buildings are all built in the early 1900s. So presumably they're going to be in substandard condition because they're just so old.
Right. So that's. You know, and that really gets into the nitty gritty. So what happens when you have a building that was built in 1900, but, you know, and you have, I don't know, 15 apartments, but seven of them were renovated previously and made market, you know, because through high rent vacancy decontrol, right?
Yeah.
Where does that leave you?
That's what I never understood was how can you actually do a sub rehab on a building that was partially free market in the first place? It makes complete sense if the building was completely rent stabilized. And then you do a sub rehab on it, but to do one on a partially free market building never really made sense to me.
Well, I think
I've even seen people do them on mostly free market buildings.
I think
an insurance kind of.
Exactly. I think it's insurance, but after the 2019 law, after the Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act, because they became stuck with the rent-stabilized units that weren't previously deregulated, this was the only way out. It was the only way to really unlock value.
Absolutely.
So, yes, I mean, you know, it's an interesting question. Why would you spend millions of dollars to do a substantial rehabilitation if some or most of your units are independently fair market? But I think one of the biggest weaknesses in these proposed amendments is that there's no way to get a binding order or opinion from the DHCR as to whether or not you are in substandard condition prior to doing the work.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's intentional on their part. It very well may be because it's a way to keep apartments stabilized. But you have to be a very courageous or aggressive owner, you know, to invest this kind of money, replace 75 or at least 75% of systems and not know that the answer to that threshold question. I think that's going to be a very big issue, and I think there probably will be litigation over it.
Makes sense. Yeah. You think there's going to be situations where DHCR, because they provide opinion letters, right, on if they think it will qualify, they provide an opinion saying they believe it should qualify for substantial rehabilitation, and then they go to file the application and it gets denied. Do you know of cases where that's happened?
I usually try to get prior, or in the past, I've tried to get prior opinions. They are useful because you do take the agency's temperature on the project as a whole, and you do get, you know, you get some feedback from them. The problem with doing the prior opinion, I had clients come to me from another law firm, a very big and prestigious law firm. And they filed for a prior opinion letter and they had already started the work. And what DHCR told them in the prior opinion letter was that they would not qualify under any circumstances because The building was not 80% vacant when the work started.
Hmm.
So now you're in a position, they were in a position where it started the work. They had had people leave. They were mid-construction, but you have this prior opinion, which although is not a binding order, basically says to you, you're never going to qualify. And that's the risk that you run with filing prior opinions or for prior opinions. So to your question, yes, I think that in the past, I've always recommended getting the prior opinions, even though it's not a binding order, but you don't even know what the DHCR will do to you in the context of getting the prior opinion.
What about like the term constructive occupancy where someone it's not the building's not fully vacant, but you get a tenant to temporarily relocate to a different apartment. So the building does become completely vacant and then the person renovates, you know, the full building. Does constructive occupancy count towards it being completely vacant?
So I think you're asking if it counts towards the 80%.
Yeah.
So
or 100% or whatever it is.
So I think the DHCR, you technically don't need to do anything in the rent stabilized, occupied rent stabilized apartments in order to effectuate a substantial rehabilitation. So you could essentially leave those apartments alone, not do anything, and be all right and still qualify. But what I think a lot of landlords find is that it's very hard to do construction work around an occupied, you know, when there's an occupied apartment.
Well, you have to do 100% of the work to 75% of the systems, right? So if I'm replacing 100% of the plumbing systems, that's one of the systems.
Mm-hmm.
How can I do that with someone still living there, right?
There are cases, which are still good law, that say that you don't have to do work in systems in occupied apartments. But I understand your question.
Yeah.
How do you replace risers because that's, you know, that get to the fifth floor
yeah.
of a building if there's a rent stabilized tenant on the fourth floor? The agency's position, at least historically, and I would say even today, is that in that you don't need to do work in occupied rent stabilized units. However, most, at least my experience, is that we do get the tenants out and we do the work so that we do, in fact, do 100% of 75%.
Got it.
That's the better practice for sure.
I've seen a lot of clients just end up taking tenants and getting them in a hotel room for like a month and then bringing them back in or putting them in another apartment they have in another building while they're doing the work.
Yeah.
So what about fires? So does that mean that any building that's had a fire would automatically qualify for sub-rehab?
No. I mean, the genesis, a lot of the older cases that deal with substantial rehabilitations are the product of fires, where there's a big fire in the building. Now, what's interesting, and one thing that we didn't touch on in what the amendments do, is that right now, as the law stands today, the law is a little unclear as to whether or not you have to restore a tenant who's rendered out of possession because of a fire. And what landlords did historically, or at least what some landlords did, was if they reconfigured the apartment that the tenant was out of possession of substantially enough, they would make an argument to the DHCR, which was actually approved by the DHCR, that the unit no longer existed and therefore the tenant didn't have to be restored.
Hmm.
The DHCR has now amended or is now amending the code to say as long as the tenant gets what's called a fire order, it's those $1 orders that say pay the landlord $1 a month following a fire or a vacate order. It doesn't necessarily need to be a fire. The landlord cannot reconfigure the unit and the landlord must restore the tenant to possession, irrespective of what he chooses to do to the apartment.
But how would a fire not, in fact, make the building substandard condition if it's not livable?
That's the thing. I mean, there are fires that only affect one floor, one apartment.
Yeah.
So the fire would, knock on wood, have to affect the whole building and render the whole building uninhabitable.
I mean, most fires I've seen in buildings, the whole entire building vacates, and then a lot of times they want to come back. There was actually a building I sold in Hell's Kitchen not that long ago where that was the case. The building was just not, no one could live in there numerous different reasons. And then, so that owner ended up doing a sub rehab,
mm-hmm.
and then then half the tenants came back.
Mm-hmm.
So now if he ever want to resell it, the selling point is if these rent stabilized tenants ever leave,
that's right.
They're actually free market.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah.
I mean, that perversely creates some value, you know, to the owner.
Absolutely.
That's right. But it's going to be interesting to see how they interpret the new amendments with respect to fires.
So, and what about, so I know this is more on the state legislation side, but there was something of the state legislation, correct me if I'm wrong, that they were going to enforce owners to file the sub rehab.
Yes.
I know this doesn't have to do with the new DHCR amendments, but can you explain that a little bit?
That's a good question.
That is a great question. And that's, I would say, probably one of the two biggest differences between the legislation
mm-hmm.
and the DHCR amendments. So the legislation, in addition to doing everything that we just discussed, would force owners to file exemption applications on any building that was where they would ever want to claim an exemption based on substantial rehabilitation, mm-hmm. regardless of when the sub rehab occurred. Within, it was either 6 months or a year of the effective date of the legislation. Mm-hmm. Now, aside, we'll talk about why that would be terrible for landlords. The institution that would be the worst for, the unintended consequence would be the DHCR. The DHCR has a years-long backlog on overcharge complaints now. Can you imagine, you know, even if you're talking about 300 or 400 applications, sub-rehab applications, and it would probably be more, they would be inundated. They don't have the manpower. They don't have the ability to handle that kind of volume. And I think that's why the amendments, which again are promulgated by the DHCR, don't have that requirement.
Hmm.
Now, it's also good for landlords, right? Because you never really want to take the fight to DHCR or to court if you don't have to.
Yeah.
And the way that the law is set up today, you only have to prove the sub rehab if you're challenged. And let's think about where we could be challenged. We could be challenged in just an ordinary overcharge complaint at DHCR or in Supreme Court. Could be investigated or audited by the tenant protection unit. It could come up in the context of a non-payment proceeding or a holdover proceeding. So if you had a problem tenant, but the place where it'll definitely come up is, and you're almost sure of this, is in the context of a sale. So if you're buying a building now and you want to sub-rehab it, and you want to exit at some point in time, you're going to have to prove to your next buyer that you did the work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like the lack of the filing requirement is, you know, absolves the owner of any responsibility. He'll still have to prove the sub-rehab at some point in time if he ever wants to exit. But at least you don't have to go to the agency, put it in their face and say, did I do a good job, right?
I think for brokers, it actually makes it a lot better because it gives like a lot more transparency to
– And clarity.
Clarity to everything. Obviously, like we don't have as much skin in the game as – A lot of our clients do. So
you're
I'm sure
if people have to file.
If you have to file, then it gives a lot more transparency and clarity on
the worst
everything.
Thing is a broker is for a client to come to you and be like, yeah, I have a free market building. I sub rehabbed it. And you're like, oh, great. You know, it looks great. They did a lot of work. But then like you don't
then have. You have someone like me digging in and nitpicking every single document.
They don't have 50% of the stuff that you're going to want. So, I mean,
you imagine a world even, and I know like you said, like DHCR doesn't have the manpower for this. But even in the past, if people were just able to get like certificates once they did an IAI on a unit,
it's so great.
It would make life so much easier. But the problem is there's so much gray area, and that's what makes our jobs so difficult.
I think the flip side of that, though, is if this requirement did go into effect, you would have many buildings that didn't qualify for some rehab that are being treated as fair market.
It's true.
On that basis. And then, you know, the effects of that are, you know, could be devastating in some buildings, mm-hmm. or could be not so bad in others, depending on what your rent records look like and what your registration history looks like. So it's a double-edged sword, but I think you do raise a good point. Clarity and certainty are, I mean, they're important in this business, but I think everybody that buys, or most people that buy real estate in New York, are not, they're not risk averse people. Yeah. I think. I mean, they understand that there is going to be a certain degree of risk here, and I think that's where a lot of opportunity is born. Yeah, right.
And there are buildings with the sub rehab certificates. Like, what do you? So, like, what would you think a building with a sub rehab certificate? Like, what's the difference as far as value? Like, how much more can the owner get for having that?
It's really hard, obviously, in my opinion, to put a number on that.
On a cap rate.
You have certainty. I mean, listen, we have sold deals with the cert, and people are very interested in that.
Yeah.
It's not something we see often. We were actively, I mean, if this means anything, there's a big fund buying a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
We were actively executing a deal with them. This building did not have the sub rehab, although it had a very, very, very good file for one.
Mm-hmm.
And it was getting done at $3.2 million. Okay. And while the contract was being negotiated, DHCR delivered a sub rehab and the price went from 3.2 to 3.6. So that's I do know that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how that buyer did come up in price. I don't know if there was an exact dollar amount formula that was run.
I mean,
but
I think like anything, right?
Yeah.
The less risky, the less of a return someone's willing to take. So if you have the sub rehab, it in fact should add value to the building in some certain way.
Absolutely. I mean, that is essentially, I mean, it's gold. I mean, it's unassailable. And it's a guarantee. That is a guarantee. That's a true guarantee.
Yeah.
But owners that do have the certificate aren't going to negotiate on their price. And it probably means that not every buyer will be interested in buying a building for top dollar because people do look for opportunity. So again, I think it's a double-edged sword. You know, I don't know that everybody wants to pay top dollar for a building.
Yeah.
Some people are willing to take the risk and pay less.
What I'm thinking of in particularly is a lot of these buildings that go through the sub rehab, especially in Manhattan, mostly in Manhattan and like really good parts of Brooklyn, end up getting sold to a foreign buyer for the most part. A lot of Japanese firms, especially. And if you have the sub rehab, I feel like a buyer like that will definitely, since they're looking for something that's easy to manage, clean, well maintained, them having that certainty is gonna add a ton of value to that type of sale.
Let's keep going through these amendments to the rent stabilization code, because I want to get through them and then we can give our opinions on the market and all that stuff. But just one thing I want to touch on real quick, because these amendments to the code that just got passed in the Senate bill, we talked about this before we started recording, but there's a lot of similarities between the two. And you mentioned, you think your opinion is that now maybe the Senate bill doesn't get signed because these new laws went into effect. So you're basically saying that you think all of a sudden the requirement to file for sub rehab may not be on the table anymore.
That's right. I think that because, I mean, listen, I don't have a crystal ball, but if I'm Kathy Hochul and if I'm the state legislature now, most of what I wanted, well, most of what the legislature wanted is enshrined in these amendments.
Mm-hmm.
So the legislation, for the most part, becomes moot.
Got it.
Are there some things that aren't incorporated in here? Yes, the legislation makes it easier for there to be a finding of fraud in the context of certain J51 buildings, and it gives you a different formula for calculating rents based on overcharges. What's interesting about that, and I don't know if you guys want to discuss this, is that essentially what those are Regina repealer bills. So That's part of the Senate bill,
okay.
Right? The legislation.
Legislation.
And
what do you, hang on, just to clarify, you call the Senate bill the legislation,
right.
And you call these amendments to the rent
DHCR amendments.
Okay, got
right,
it.
Right,
okay.
Right. So the legislation, well, the DHCR amendments encapsulate almost everything that the legislation does, but for the requirement to file the application based on substantial rehabilitation and what I'm going to call the Regina repealer aspects of the legislation. And what the legislation seeks to do is make it much easier for a landlord to be found guilty of fraud and have what's called the default formula applied to calculate rents. And, you know, the legislature, you know, wants to is much more tenant the legislation rather is much more tenant friendly on the overcharge aspects than the DHCR amendments are. And I think we're the industry will be pretty lucky if we're able to avoid the legislation this term. Because if the legislation is signed, and there are two bills actually, and the second bill, which really hasn't been discussed a lot, would really change the way that we look at overcharges where we can't prove deregulations. So fingers crossed that nothing happens with them.
Man, maybe we can come back to this stuff. It's just it's a lot of nitty gritty complex
there's
stuff.
A slight whim, this DHCR thing out of left field.
Well, we don't know yet.
Maybe if they don't sign the legislation,
he believes it should be a
win. A lot of this redundant.
I listen, Kathy Hochul. So the way that it'll work is the legislation is currently has not been sent to the governor. The legislation does not have to be sent to the governor. If it doesn't go to her desk by the end of the term, which is, I think, either the end of the year or the first week of January, the legislation dies by itself. If it goes to the governor, she has to sign or veto it. If she does neither, it automatically becomes law. So...
Oh, wow.
That's stupid.
Well, that's the way it goes. But I think, my own opinion, is that this probably won't even get sent to her now because the legislature got so much of what it wanted in the amendments that Kathy Hochul won't ask for it and the legislature won't send it. And it'll just die and she won't have to look like a bad guy. To tenants.
Yeah, but there's people out there a lot that thought that was going to happen anyway, and did, now they just introduced this DHCR
amendments
that just kind of screwed that up. This could have just died altogether, and now they just involve themselves.
So
it's like crazy.
You raise, I think, one of the best points, or you touch on one of the best or most important points here. You know, we all are part of an industry that is maybe after finance the biggest industry in New York, the real estate industry. And I don't think that there's anybody in our industry that has a line to Albany, that has a line to the governor's office, that has a line to, you know, the leadership in the assembly and in the Senate that will talk to us, that will tell us what's going on, that will listen to us. And that is, you know, I think partly a product of the fact that real estate is viewed as toxic by the far left.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also a product of the fact that real estate as an industry is not working together enough. And I think that anybody listening to this podcast needs to think about that because it's not for a want of money. I mean, that's one thing that the industry has plenty of. So it really is a problem. We don't have a voice in Albany. Nobody is talking to us. And I don't know if that's been your experience, but I think that that's a fact. There's nobody that you can call that nobody told us these were coming on November 8th. Nobody. You would think that the lobby or the strategists or whoever it is that's you know running the real estate industry show here would have some insight. And it's that puts us at a very big disadvantage. And that, I think, has to change because, yes, there are bad landlords out there. There are.
Of course.
But
there's bad tenants out there, too.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There are plenty of small landlords and plenty of good landlords. And this stuff, these amendments, are going to really, if not put them out of business, make it very difficult to own in New York. And a very unattractive.
These amendments are?
Yeah.
So what's so unattractive about these minutes? I mean, we touched on sub rehab. I don't think we need to go back there.
This guy, are you a trader?
No. I feel like the demolition clause is really not applicable.
It happens so infrequently.
Well, we can get to that. Yeah,
okay, so now we're getting
to what in the sub rehab? I kind of agree with you because in the sub rehab, there wasn't a big surprise to me. Obviously,
there's not a lot
good.
Of people doing sub rehab. It's a very small portion of the market, and they're professional developers that are doing it.
It's really the elimination of the first rents. That's really
the combination.
But that
let's get into the combination.
Yeah, let's get into the combination.
Are we done with sub rehab though?
Yeah. I mean, we could get as nitty gritty.
Talk to me, Luke. Talk to me.
What's the last question?
So maybe I wasn't paying attention enough, but you mentioned so
it's hard to follow all this stuff. You're doing a great job.
I'm doing my best.
Everyone's talking about buildings being in substandard condition, right? And we could all say what we think it is, but at least substandard. Is something obtainable, right? A lot of these buildings are in substandard condition. There's easy ways to figure it out. You could figure out when something is not, when it's past its useful life. You could have pictures, pre-construction. You have someone's opinion. Yes, this is in bad shape. But you said uninhabitable, right? Mm-hmm. Uninhabitable can be something without a roof. Like that is insane. So
uninhabitable means a shell.
Is uninhabitable? Is that in any legislation
it's
anywhere?
It's not.
You scare me with this.
The word uninhabitable does not appear in the legislation, and it doesn't appear in the DHCR amendments or the rent stabilization code. Where it does appear is in some recent cases that were decided by DHCR. And we're stuck before these people whether we like it or not.
Yeah.
So if that's the new test that they're going to apply, and I'm not saying that it is. I'm just saying this is what they did in the most recent cases that they decided, that constitutes a change. And I think what I'm saying to you is it's subjective. A presumption is not subjective. You've got the 80% vacancy and it's a fact, right? Now, might you need to prove that it actually was substandard condition if you were challenged? Yes. But now we're moving away from that and we're going to a completely subjective standard. What is substandard or seriously deteriorated? There's not a lot of case law on it because for the last 30 years, maybe more, we've basically relied on the presumption. Everybody relied on the presumption. And it's very hard to rebut that presumption because who's there to say what the building was before the work was done? There's nobody left.
What is the context of the word uninhabitable that they're like using in like these denials of these sub rehab applications? Like
because this is new to me. I didn't even know there was a denial for that.
So. Like how is it being written with the word uninhabitable?
So
I haven't seen these these cases.
I'll send it to you. It's an 18-page decision. It's a lot of fun.
It's a recent one.
within the last 3 or 4 months.
Was there other reasons why it was denied?
Yes.
All the denials I've seen, like you know, there's this whole thing about like the PW3s matching the cost affidavits, and there's the other one with the PW1 and the
occupancy,
the altering 50% or more of the property, where they're like, well, you check no that you weren't altering 50% or more of the property with the OB, but then you come to DHCR and you say it's more than 75%, and you told DOB that you spent $250,000
on a million,
but you skip us receipts for. Right. So, like, it's a series of a number of things that come together where I've seen the denials, but
so in the cases that I'm referring to, yes, one of the cases, you know, it was an absolutely egregious application that was put together, and that's why I strongly suggest to everyone that they use lawyers. Doesn't necessarily have to be me. I'd love it, but
You have to.
But you have to use a lawyer. And what I think a lot of owners out there did was they don't want to spend tens of thousands of dollars doing an application. So they go to other people, other outfits, and it doesn't necessarily work out for them. But in the context of the cases that I'm talking about, there were buyouts that were done. The owner wouldn't have qualified even putting aside the substandard condition because they didn't do enough of the work. I mean, they claim that they spent something ridiculous like $75,000 sub rehabbing a building, right? That's what the PW3 showed. So it was just an egregious underestimate or misrepresentation, if you will, depending on how you look at it, to the DOB. So do I think these cases are outliers? I hope so. I think so. But that's what we're dealing with today. And, you know, if someone comes to me today and says, I want to substantially rehabilitate, you know, you have to tell the client, you have to tell a person, this is what is out there now. And you have to make your own decision because there is no real clarity. There is no clearness or certainty in what the DHCR is going to do with this threshold issue. So it just makes it also very hard to practice as an attorney.
So just touching it, and then we'll put this one to bed. And obviously I'm not asking you to go through every little step, but if someone came to you and I said, hey, I'm buying this building, do you give this your blessing? Obviously I'm not going to have you go through the PW3s and all that stuff right now, but I think the easiest thing that we come up to on the phone is, hey, this building doesn't qualify, it's not substandard. So in your opinion, right, what if I showed you a building, what to you tells you it's substandard? Like if I showed you a six family in Williamsburg, what are you asking for me to show you it's substandard?
So, just want to be clear, I'm not offering a legal opinion.
I know, but I know.
I'd want to see photographs showing holes in the walls, sagging floors, rusted windows, you know, very old radiators that are rusted. You know, I'd want to know, you know, what kind of electrical service is provided. Maybe the amps aren't up to, you know, modern standards. I'd want to see old bathrooms, you know, old kitchens. I'd want to see, you know, old stairways, you know, that look like they're very old. I'd want to see a facade that looks like it hasn't been, you know, pointed in years.
I mean,
those are the things I'd want to see in terms of pictures. I'd want an affidavit from a registered architect or professional engineer who went and inspected, you know, maybe did some invasive tests also to see, you know,
for sure
what was there. I'd like to look at HPD violations. HP actions started by tenants are also a good place to start. If the tenants are alleging conditions in the building that make it uninhabitable, that could be used to your advantage. But you have to be, you know, you have to be careful with that, because if an owner is creating conditions just to make the building substandard or seriously deteriorated for the purpose of doing a sub rehab, you're not going to be rewarded for that.
Can they prove that? Like, how does it stop someone from buying a building, going in,
a sledgehammer?
I'm not saying obviously this is fraud, but like destroying it and being like, they can never in their life prove it. They could cut a hole in the ceiling and, oh, it rained really hard and look at this. Like, you can't.
It's a good question. I generally tell my clients not to do it.
It's something I thought about, but, though. Like,
no. So for sure. Look. It's subjective, right? I mean, this just goes back to it's subjective.
These are building-wide systems. So, like, there's a lot of systems that are building-wide that you can't just, like, intentionally damage it doesn't work.
Plumbing.
Like if you're saying it's in a substandard or seriously deteriorated condition.
Correct.
To me, I like looking at the IRS useful life schedule.
Yep. And there's a useful life schedule in the rent stabilization code with respect to MCIs, major capital improvements, that I've looked at.
Even if you look at just depreciation for an apartment building of like 27 and a half years, and let's just say like these things were here from longer than 27 and a half years ago, like you can tell if the electrical systems were upgraded or not. You can tell if the heating systems were upgraded or not. You can tell with the facade and the roof and fire escapes and the kitchens and the walls and the floors and the structural components of the property. And I think the whole cohesive story, the whole building tells the story of, is it in a substandard condition or not? Not just someone like breaking down their doors.
Yeah, and kicking a hole in the wall.
And if there's like water coming into the building from like someone cutting a hole in the roof, it's just weird.
You have to go through every system, see if every system is up to par.
It's the whole story. It's got to be.
It's got to be the story. I mean, brokers are like going to street. Like a lot of people are talking about street easy now. Like, oh, well, these units run street easy and they look fine. They're getting $2,500 a month.
They should.
I mean, do you take that into consideration? And then we'll stop with this.
It's public information. It's information you that exists it online.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think the problem is in New York – that such a crappy apartment can still fetch a decent rent.
For sure. I mean,
So this just goes back to, if you have three or four apartments in a building that can go for that much money because you've even done a cosmetic cosmetic renovation, how does that play into substandard or seriously deteriorated? You could have a nice apartment in a substandard building, right? I mean, they exist a lot. So it's going to become a very hotly contested point of litigation going forward.
Because even with you, like, obviously we're not going to get into addresses or names or anything like that, but obviously you're very well respected, or we wouldn't have you on this podcast. So there's buildings that we've... But hold on. But we've heard of deals that you've given maybe on this one. Okay. Right? So deals that we're actively working on, and obviously we take that very seriously coming from you. So what gives... what? In your head.
In terms of what? Substandard?
Yeah, like, oh, you've made comments that that building is not a good candidate for substandard. Now, is it because of what we just discussed? Like, you don't have pictures. These units are on street easy. Like, what needs to be shown to you? I mean, you kind of just covered it, obviously, but...
I think if you have 70% of units, just to talk about perhaps a building that we were discussing in passing before.
Fine.
We're... 60 or 70% of the units are being rented out at market rate. How can you make that argument with a straight face?
Done. Right? I agree with you. Yeah.
You can't do it there. You know, the idea, right, if you go back to the history of this, right, when mm-hmm. rent stabilization, substantial rehabilitation, and this whole idea of rehabilitating buildings was mm-hmm. enacted, you know, the Bronx was burning. New York was in a debt crisis. We were facing bankruptcy. The idea
we're getting close to that now.
Well, that's
the vacant buildings were seriously deteriorated at that point.
That's right. That's really the genesis of this. So if you bring it back to that, what we're talking about is sort of out of touch with reality, because I think the idea was, or the intention was, buildings like the ones you just discussed. Empty buildings that were really in need of help.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of grown into or evolved into something different than that, I think. So it's just subjective. No, it's just, you know it when you see it. It's sort of like...
What a mess.
You know it when you see it, hopefully.
Go ahead.
They changed the laws, and people still want to find avenues for investment.
I personally feel like this is an avenue... to really add value to a building, and it's a good business plan.
The city needs it in some cases.
As long as there's a clear, you know, treasure map to get it done.
And we're going to talk about the consequences of all of this in a minute. But one of the biggest consequences of the Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act that was passed in 2019 is that
that's a good thing
owners are keeping apartments vacant.
Yes.
They're getting apartments back. And they're not renting them, because who in their right mind is going to rent a $1,200 apartment? Which landlord in his right mind is going to put a $1,200 apartment on the market? They won't do it.
And there's way worse.
Right. And there's way worse.
Yeah.
So to your point, vacant buildings, vacant apartments, we're probably not that far off from that. You know, if the laws don't change, you're going to see a lot of apartments that are going to remain vacant until the landlords can at least hit a number in terms of rent that allows them to break even, right? You rent a $1,200 apartment now in Manhattan. If you got to call a plumber, paint it every 2 years, heat it, do the water, you're maybe breaking even with the taxes and right?
Yeah. No, so I don't even think so.
It's, you know, each building is a little bit different than what your break even number is, but it's really sad because it's driving the price of fair market units up tremendously, right? You've got probably over 50,000 rent stabilized units sitting vacant today. That number's only going to grow year over year over year. At some point, I mean, and this is the silver lining in all of this, at some point, market forces are going to force the legislature to act. Now, whether it'll force them to act in the right way or the wrong way, I don't know. But something will have to change. They'll either try to impose a vacancy tax on owners for keeping apartments vacant, which I think is unconstitutional.
Yeah, I was about to say.
And there was a case many years ago with respect to SRO units, which held that that was unconstitutional. Or they'll change... I mean, listen, all they have to do is change the IAI form, or the individual apartment improvement formulas, to make this a better situation.
Definitely.
I'm not even saying to you, bring deregulation back. I'm saying make it a 1/40th calculation and cap it at $100,000. That gives you the ability to raise the rent by $2,500, and you're at least creating some value for yourself, putting a habitable apartment, a nice apartment back on the market, and creating housing.
Yeah.
And that's what I think the people making policy don't understand.
Yeah, 100%.
The big problem is the taxes, the expenses.
They're definitely
and the
not going to reduce the taxes.
The finance
that's
side
for sure.
Of things. Yeah. And we can touch on all that, but it's
I think we can drop.
We can
drop Sabrina.
Okay, all right. Into this, obviously, yeah, it's for us. It's a very clear for me. It's a clear way to add value in New York. People are just very afraid of it because there's no clear cut answer,
nothing. And it's also all
it's
or
all
nothing.
Or nothing. There's all this gray. No one really knows, but it's upsetting because it's actually a good way to do it. Where I've, you know, we'll get into Frankenstein and all that stuff, but Frankenstein to me was always like a backdoor.
Let's keep it moving.
Yeah, let's keep it moving. Let's
Griff told me he just gave me the 1 hour signal, so okay. we talked about
sub rehab for an hour.
Sub rehab's the biggest one.
Maybe we'll bring this into episodes. Sub rehab episodes.
Well, hold on. So what's next then?
Well, all right. So just putting this into like the bullet points. We just touched on bullet point number one. Yeah. Sub rehab.
Okay.
Next. Bullet point number two of, I think, three or four, and then we can talk about the
mortgage. I'm going to start charging you guys soon. I'm going to start charging you by the hour.
Well, we got to make sure that your name and information is on here.
That could be quite expensive.
But the demolition clause, it's not really applicable to a lot of stuff that we see where people are...
I think I've seen maybe four or five demo applications, you know, in 10 years of doing this. You know, there was...
I know a guy that was doing it.
I think... It was either on 1st Avenue and 86th or 3rd Avenue and 86th where the owner, you know, there was one holdout tenant. The DHCR had gotten it all wrong. They applied the wrong standard. They said that not only did the owner have to show that he had the financial ability to demolish the building, but also the financial ability to put up whatever was going to go there. Mm-hmm. And the court, you know, to its credit, said no DHCR. That's not the standard. The standard is just the financial ability to demolish the property. But very quickly, what the amendments seek to do to demolition is, in essence, say you need to completely demolish not only the building so that it's a shell, but also get rid of the foundation, get rid of everything that's there. And that has, you know, in addition to being inefficient, I think it also has significant tax consequences for owners. Because when you, I believe, we can check with the tax attorney, once you start removing the foundation or you touch more than a certain percentage of the foundation, I think your tax class also is affected.
Or is it a filing where like people could have filed maybe an Alt-1 previously and now it's like a new build? That would have a big impact.
Yeah, that's what I was. That's
well,
what I was thinking.
We'd have to talk to an architect. I DOB is not my area, but those look. I don't know how many owners are actually doing demolitions and how many owners are actually relying on demolitions to get people out.
I know, really have doing it.
Yeah, these are big condo projects that are doing that.
Well, yeah,
big major like the things you see on First Avenue, like
for sure,
right.
The Neftali, like those are the guys that are doing that stuff.
I don't know if he is or isn't, but
he's doing it. Like a lot of these guys are demoing blah. They're putting together huge demolitions. They're demoing buildings and
right. But you get one guy that'll hold so you for years.
So now you can't do that anymore. Or
well, it just becomes harder. It becomes harder to do, but it's still available.
All right, so that's.
I don't think we're bumping into that too much. But now this elimination of the first rent rule upon combination or creation of new units. So. This was something that everyone started doing after the rent laws went into effect in 2019. Mm-hmm. Everyone was making new units, setting first market rents.
That's right. Right, subject to stabilization, right? They were creating new units, subjecting them to stabilization, but setting
a new first rent.
Right, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. So now it's basically you have to keep the legal rents, and you can, if you're changing the size of the unit, you can, you know, pro rata adjust the rents for the units.
So let's go through what's really clear.
Okay.
What's really clear is that when you're combining any stabilized unit with another stabilized unit, however you choose to reconfigure that, those apartments will never yield you more than the sum of the two rents. So if you had an apartment that rented for $700, an apartment that rented for $1,200, if you combine them together, it's $1,200. And if you reapportion them or change the outer perimeter, no matter how you do it, you're still going to be stuck at that $1,200 number, right? And you can add the $89 for IAIs. So congratulations. So you can add $89 on each apartment. So all right, $180. I had a client tell me that you could buy a towel rack for $180.
I don't even know if you could do it.
It was. So that's the easy part. What's also easy, I think, is if you have an apartment, a rent-stabilized apartment on the first floor, let's call it 1,000 square feet, with a $2,000 rent, and you duplex down and you create a recreational room, right?
Yeah.
And that's another 1,000 square feet. All you're going to be able to do there is double the rent. You'll be able to take a corresponding increase on the rent that corresponds with however many square feet you're adding to the apartment. So maybe in that situation where you're duplexing down, there's some value to be had there. What is, I think, at best for landlords, unclear is what happens when you take a rent-stabilized apartment and you start combining it with
free market,
a fair market unit. So what we know for sure is that that combined unit is going to be a rent-stabilized apartment. We know that for sure, and that's not a change. Question is, what do you do with the rent? There's a reading of the rent of the amendments that says, there's I think a legitimate reading of the amendments that may say that you're only going to be able to add to the legal regulated rent the corresponding increase that results from the square footage that's added. Again, meaning that you'd essentially be tied to whatever the legal regulated rent is. Now, I think that's draconian, and I think that the DHCR might be exceeding its authority there. So it's going to remain an open issue as to how rents are set in that context. And I think it's going to be quite some time before we know what the DHCR's answer is to that. Mm-hmm. The good news is that it doesn't appear that they're trying to capture any unit which was rented prior to November 8th. So this is only going to capture units that are rented, and I should say rented, I'm sorry, before November 8th. So anything that's been done already should be...
Similar to HSTPA.
Similar to HSTPA.
Thing. Yeah, same thing.
Similar to HSTPA. So, yeah. But the rental date, the lease commencement date, is going to be what controls for this.
Yeah.
But this was really the vehicle that most of the owners or most landlords used after 2019 to develop their rent roll, right? It was combining apartments, duplexing,
I always thought it was kind of like a weak loophole to HSTPA. It was just something like – I always felt like it was always something that they just like forgot about and people took advantage of it. And I think honestly, like when we're selling buildings that have these like high rent stabilized rents, they're never really that attractive to buyers, in my opinion, on a resale value.
Why do you think that is?
I don't know. I just think that people having the free market status and giving you that freedom and ability to dictate what the market is a lot more attractive than this kind of this loophole.
Yeah.
So, and financing, I don't know how banks really look at them.
So what's interesting about the first rent policy, though, is that the first rents are also they're found nowhere in the rent stabilization law. It's entirely an agency created policy, right? So, please.
I would ask.
And, you know, I think there's been some talk about whether or not the DHCR has exceeded its authority in doing away with first rents. And this is one place where I think the DHCR might be well within its power because the whole idea of first rents was birthed and created by DHCR. And if it was DHCR's policy to begin with, I think that as long as they follow the notice and comment requirements, which they did, they can take it back. So I am not particularly gung-ho on a challenge to this. What will be interesting, though, is what they do with stabilized and fair market combinations. Because once something is exempted from rent stabilization, it's a permanent exemption. That deregulation is permanent. So how they choose to bring it back in and how they choose to set the rents will be interesting.
Yeah, or landlords just shouldn't mess around with combining rent stabilized and free market units.
I think that that's also not a bad idea, but you know, I guess really the market of each particular building will dictate that.
Mm.
I think, you know, for right now, if you can't, you know, if you're in the middle of a project already, obviously get the lease to commence before November 8th, actually November 7th. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that you're thinking about doing this in the future, you know, I've already advised clients to take a wait and see approach.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, like you said, like you both said, you don't want to lose a fair market apartment. Fair market apartments are gold, right? It's the only place that you can really develop your rent. So if you're taking this, thank you. If you're taking this apartment and subjecting it to stabilization, that's not great to begin with. But if there's a limitation on your rent also, I mean, that's catastrophic. That doesn't make any sense. So it's really a wait and see approach, I think, on that.
For me, I mean, I don't know a lot of clients that did this as a business plan, right? Like sub rehab, obviously, there's a lot of that, right? Purchasing a bad building, sub rehabbing it, that makes sense. But have people really paid a premium, say, you know what, I'm going to buy this building, I'm going to Frankenstein units? I think a lot of the time I hear about it, it's like
they got
screwed by the 2019 law. And this is a backdoor way to regain some equity and some upside. But it's everyone kind of uses it as a loophole backdoor thing where it's like, okay, I'm in this situation.
Well, it doesn't really work in small. I mean, it you know, you'd really need a large building for it to work as a building as a business plan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't. You know, what are you going to do in a 10-unit building? How many units can you possibly combine?
Yeah.
You
know,
cheap for people to duplexing units in the middle of the building. People
right. Are, you know, and that's not the best use. I mean, that doesn't necessarily give you an optimal rent roll either. It's just better than what the alternative is, which is $2,500 rents.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't think there aren't a lot of people who do this as a, you're right. I mean, truth be told, you know, this really only became a thing after June of 2019, and then you had COVID, which also threw a wrench into it. So you're right. I don't think a lot of people have executed it as a business plan. And I think probably in the middle market, which we're dealing with, it's not particularly attractive because you don't have enough room to do it. The buildings just don't lend themselves even physically to doing it.
And if you haven't done it already, like you're probably not doing it anyway, right? Like everyone that did this was like, oh, right, 2020, 21, like they had it. They're like, oh, we got these vacant, but honestly, like the only thing that really I saw in this was, again, we talked about it a lot, but sub rehab and this Frankenstein, it's not a good thing. It's for landlords. I think it's bad because if you do clear up two RS units next to each other, you can't do it anymore. But I always looked at that as, like I said, a backdoor loophole that them closing, it's an obvious closure for them. Like they should close it. I mean,
well, but you know, then there's really no way to develop your rent roll now then, other than just doing value adds to fair market units. I mean, that's really all that's left.
That's it.
That's really all there is. And all that means is that the rents on these fair market units are just going to continue to climb. That's all it means, which is also not great for the city, right?
Yeah.
It's also not great for the city.
It's not good for any of us.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I think that's the main thing. I think we can, you know, maybe talk about this last point here on the amendments and then just talk about the broader market and what we're seeing and the consequences of HSTPA and the second order, third order events that have happened. But moving on from the combination of units and setting the first rent, the last main amendment that I understand is succession rights.
Yes, succession rights.
Okay, so yeah, go ahead.
So, you know, again, after 2019 – gaining possession of a rent stabilized apartment from an owner's perspective is a lot less valuable, right? You really don't want rent state.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose you'd want them for the purpose of combining, but you know, there's no real impetus to get them back anymore. But what the DHCR amendments are going to do to succession is that, one, and I know that this necessarily falls under succession, but we'll put it there, it requires an owner to add a domestic partner to a lease, so it's not limited to spouses anymore. And two, what it also does is it relaxes the standard that a successor or a putative successor needs to show in order to become the rent-stabilized tenant. So what it means, I think what the amendments do is that they essentially say that, you know, the time is measured from the date that the rent-stabilized tenant vacates the apartment. And even if the rent-stabilized tenant continues to sign leases or remit rent after the point that they say that they vacated, that's not fraud. It's merely a factor that you consider in whether or not the son or the daughter or the niece or the nephew should have succession. It's really, I mean, they're really allowing tenants to pass these apartments on. It's just like circus batons, I mean, is what it is. But again, I think from a landlord's perspective now, there's no real motivation to get these apartments back. And that's exactly what the legislature wanted.
Yeah, I think the owners want the rent stabilized tenants to keep their units at this point. They don't want them back.
It's not just I'm not even sure that it's that, and this really goes to consequences. What it really is they don't want a landlord to want the apartment back. They don't want the landlord to create housing instability. They don't want there to be a financial motive for the landlord to say, that apartment is worth something to me now.
Yeah.
I don't think the legislature cares whether it's me, you, or Joe Schmo that's occupying the apartment as a stabilized tenant.
They don't care if it's a millionaire or someone that actually needs that.
Yeah. Right. They don't.
They don't.
They don't. But what they do care about is that the landlord doesn't have an incentive to try to get the tenants out. And they've succeeded marvelously. In doing that.
I don't want to go too long on this, but I had one just very curious question. What are the tenants' rights to renovate their rent stabilized apartment? Do they have the ability to do whatever they want?
Good question.
Can they make it in this luxury apartment?
So it really depends on what the lease says and what the landlord allows them to do. They generally are not allowed to alter the apartment significantly without the landlord's permission.
Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's up to the owner, essentially.
Usually it's based on what the lease says, but I would say in 95% of cases, that's true.
And how are owners open to letting tenants do that in your experience?
I think it really depends on the owner and what the circumstance is. What you're seeing a lot of now, what I'm seeing a lot of now, is that a lot of older tenants in rent-stabilized apartments want to make renovations so that their
kids can have a nice apartment.
Reasonable accommodations based on the fact that they have mobility issues, so they want walk-in showers or they want bigger kitchens because their mobility is declining. So what you're also going to see, I think, is a lot of older rent-stabilized tenants really hanging on to these bigger apartments because they have nowhere to go. It's just too expensive to go anywhere else. And that's one of these other unintended consequences. These tenants – the other unintended consequence, actually, thank you.
Yeah.
I reminded myself. So prior to 2019, any rent-stabilized tenant – almost anywhere, maybe with the exception of the Bronx and Staten Island, was sitting on what was essentially equity.
Yeah.
Because landlords were going to buy them out of their leases so they could move to Florida so that they could, go live with their kids, whatever. That no longer exists here. So tenants are stuck. Rent-stabilized tenants are stuck. They don't have that, essentially a nest egg. Mm-hmm. They don't have that $60,000, $100,000 nest egg that they would have had prior to the enactment of the 2019 law. And I think that what you're seeing is these tenants are hanging on to the apartments basically until they die because they're priced out of going anywhere else. You know, it's interesting. I had a tenant in my client had a tenant in Brooklyn. We were trying to make a deal with him for years, and every time we would come close to a deal, he'd renege. Now he's calling me 3 times a month, trying to get, you know, any sort of money. Wow. For the apartment. He's just saying, give me my moving expenses. And I said, my client won't do it because there's no financial motivation.
Sucks. Wow.
There's no financial motivation. So it's just, the legislature got exactly what it wanted in this. But it's going to also get terrible, dilapidated housing.
It wanted to eliminate the incentive for landlords to vacate apartments. That's really what it was going for. That's like we were talking about it before the show, like the viewpoint of the other side, like what their goals are, what they're trying to accomplish. So that's basically it. Eliminate the incentive to destabilize housing in New York or cause units to become vacant.
That's right.
Got it.
And they're not hiding it. You know, the legislatures aren't. Legislators, excuse me, aren't hiding it from you either. Now, a client pointed out to me about 2 weeks ago an interview that I think it's Julie Salazar. I don't remember if she's a state senator or assembly person, gave the real deal a couple of years ago. And she came right out and said it. We don't believe that people should make profit on housing. That's what a large segment of the
hence why they hate landlords.
Democratic Party wants.
Democrat Socialist.
The DSA wants. Mm-hmm. That's what they want. That they don't believe in it. They don't. They think housing universal. Is a human right. They think housing is a human right. Mm-hmm. And maybe it is. Okay? But if housing is a human right, then the government should provide it. It shouldn't be on our clients or private property owners to provide it.
What's so backwards and unfair about it is just the pressure it's putting on people that didn't get that lucky, you know, rent stabilized.
Yes,
unit,
sure.
And what it's done to rents across the city. And and then they get rid of, like, you know, the 421A and just the incentives to build and supply. And there's just so much demand and such a lack of supply.
Yeah. So I think too, like what I'm seeing from somebody in their, you know, early to mid 30s is usually this is the time where, you know, we want to start having our own families and having kids and so forth. And a lot of my people in my friendship circle, they can't figure out how to be able to stay in the city, even though as much as they enjoy living here.
No, you need three roommates.
Because it's impossible. It's impossible financially raise a family in the city unless you're a really high earner.
I was having a conversation just this past weekend with people in my neighborhood, and like we talk a lot about what it's done to the fair market rents. Yeah. But that's also translated into housing prices for like home purchases and condo purchases. There's people want to be in the city and there's not enough supply of these units. So people are paying millions of dollars for townhouses and condos. And, you know, meanwhile, you have all these units that were just taken out of the market. So I guess it worked with this finite subset of the population. But, you know, all the rest of the population has put all this pressure on. It's been really a bad outcome for the rest of us.
What's crazy too is like the city obviously says, oh, you can raise it $100 and it doesn't cost anything to renovate apartments. But then, you know, I was talking to a friend that's a landlord in the Bronx, and, you know, with all these programs, the homeless programs and whatever it is, the city is paying huge rents to landlords to put these types of people in buildings.
Like they entered regulatory agreements. Like,
For them, it's like, oh, a studio. I've heard crazy things. Studios in the Bronx, $2,900.
Yeah. Yep.
They're paying huge money to house these people.
And who's paying that money?
Taxpayers. Yeah, so exactly. It's crazy. So they'll pay that much, but then they're like, oh, no, you can't. This apartment, you have to charge $500, and here's $1 to renovate the kitchen. It's like, but
they're completely out of touch with reality.
It's like hypocrisy and like it's just insane.
So Alex, what is it going to take for the other side to actually understand? Because we're obviously a little biased, but what's it going to take for them to understand like how devastating these laws are and how this is all going to change?
You know, Derek asked me when we came in, you know, what he wanted, I think, to hear, you know, what's the other side's argument. So, confession, I grew up in a rent-stabilized apartment. You know, I think that what you have to understand on the other side is, okay, let's assume rent stabilization went away, right? You've now pulled from under them, or pulled from under the, you've pulled the rug from under a million, 2 million people in New York. Where do they go? Their life assumptions have been completely turned upside down. What happens? You know, I think rent stabilization is probably the single most important piece of legislation in New York. It affects millions of people, and it keeps blue-collar people here. It keeps the middle class here. The people who are protected. So I think the flip side of this is, okay, in a landlord's perfect world, rent stabilization doesn't exist. And I've heard people say to me, and I've heard studies done, well, that would actually have the effect of driving down rents as a whole. There's, nobody knows what would happen absent rent stabilization. Nobody knows what would happen, you know, if these protections are taken away. So I think we need to find a middle ground. And I think that between 1997 and 2019, so 1997 was the Rent Reform Act that really allowed deregulation and IAIs, and 2019, which was the end of that, the pendulum had really swung in favor of the landlords. And there was a lot of abuse of the system, because DHCR didn't make you file a certificate to get IAIs. DHCR didn't look into how tenants were, how apartments were vacated. So there were guys out there that were not doing the right thing. And that's part of the reason why I think our industry is looked at as being toxic. So unfortunately, we're not going to come back to a middle until things get really bad. Really bad is probably having 150,000 empty apartments in New York City that will not be rented until they can be brought to something more than the $1,200 rents that the outgoing tenant paid. I don't know how you make the other side understand. I think that, you know, you have to, you know, Chip did a very good, well, Chip did a very good, or tried to do a marketing campaign where they showed all these vacant apartments and how little small-time owners were getting hurt. But, you know, it needs to be bigger than that. You know, it needs to be people can't live in this city because there's no housing. It needs to be, you know, rents on these market. It needs to be only the really rich or the really poor are going to be able to live here.
What it's becoming. It's becoming a city where it's either you're a really, really high net worth individual or earner, or you're somebody on the complete opposite side of the spectrum. But the in-between, which a majority of people are in-between, these are the people that are getting left in the dust. And
you're getting pushed out.
Right, and that's what rent stabilization, you know,
I think generally in the tax code too, that's also kind of similar type of situation in the tax code, where the high net worth individuals get away with paying less in taxes, and so do the complete opposite. But the people who are in the upper tier middle class are the ones who get left behind.
I'd probably risk losing some phone calls by saying this, but rent stabilization as an idea is not a bad thing. I mean, it's there to make sure that there is a middle class that can afford.
I think most people agree with that.
So it's just gotten so perverted and so distorted that these apartments essentially become, you know, they've essentially become property of the tenants is what's happened. And if you're not able to unlock some of that value as those apartments become vacant, it becomes just a really rich city on the one end and a really poor city on the other. And there's got to be a middle ground. Maybe what we had up to 2019 wasn't it, because we were losing tens of thousands of rent stabilized apartments a year. But maybe there's a way that you bring back IAIs and you don't bring back deregulation, or you bring back deregulation in phases, or you know, or only in certain parts of the city. I mean, there are ways that this can be done. But there's just no political appetite for it.
And I think we're also forgetting, too, that there's no 421A tax abatement. So that lottery of
affordable housing,
yeah. that's gonna dry up eventually, right?
If it's not renewed next session, yeah.
And by the way, like those income thresholds on those lotteries too, they're pretty strict. Like it's tough to get an apartment.
It's tough to qualify.
Yep. Because most likely, if you're looking for that apartment, you weren't living in New York anyways. Because you weren't making enough money to live in New York.
It's true.
So it's like it's just crazy. It doesn't make sense. Yeah, it's
true. So you think that's the only way, Hala? There needs to be like just a huge amount of vacancy. I mean, the thing with Chip is they did a decent job, but it's a very small subset of people even know what Chip is. Like just like my sister, right? She's not in real estate. But she knows New York. She used to live here, but she doesn't know what Chip is. No one would. So they have to like bring it to like the masses.
I think it's the tenants need to speak out more than the landlords, because I think at the end of the day, the government officials view landlords as the enemy. But if tenants more in like the middle to upper class start lobbying in some sort of sense, be like, how do we live here? Like that's the main.
There's gonna be no money in these rent-stabilized buildings to do basic repairs, roof repairs, heating repairs, facade. No one's going to put money into these properties, especially when the value – I mean, there's been sales now. So this is like – we know where the value has gone. And like the one portfolio in Upper Manhattan sold for like a 44% discount.
Talking about the signature – are you talking about signature?
No, I'm talking about it. Okay. But I mean, I just saw this week in Pincus, there was a $72 million foreclosure going on a portfolio of these rent-stabilized buildings.
But my point is that means something to us as people who work in the industry. That doesn't mean anything to the politicians.
I don't agree with you.
I think the politicians, they just see rich people losing a little bit of money. That's what they see from that. I think what they care more about is the tenants, the people who are actually living in the city.
Wait until owners can't do repairs to buildings, and HPD is going to have to start coming in and doing emergency repairs. They're going to start filing liens on properties where owners can't pay, and these properties – and people are going to start walking away from the buildings because there's no – financial cash flow to maintain the property. So I mean, there's a clear scenario where that starts to happen.
But I went through the living expense numbers and what you actually have to earn to raise a family here, and like to be able to actually raise a family here, you have to combine with your partner somewhere at least in the vicinity of $450,000 a year, which is I don't know the exact numbers, but I guarantee you it's much higher than 95% to 98% of the rest of the country.
I also saw something in Cranes that said basically people need to get out and vote. When's the election?
November 7th.
It's next week. There's an election, but people need to get out and vote. And it said voter turnout in New York is abysmal. So people
and the people that do turn out to vote. Are very partisan, and they vote for the fringes. They vote for the primaries are really where elections in New York are decided, and it's you get very extreme people.
Yeah. Well, going back to what you were saying earlier, people are uneducated. Like, I know a majority of my friends that aren't in real estate. They know nothing. They know nothing about how the economics of how it actually is to operate buildings in the city and how housing actually works in the city. So I think that's another issue too, is the majority of New Yorkers are like, why is my rent so high? And they just go on CNBC and they say inflation is high and that's the reason. But there's so much, but it's not that.
It's not just that.
It's not just that. I mean, it's partially that, but it's much more. And I don't think the politicians are going to realize it until the tenants start speaking
until the New Yorkers start speaking up. Is the people that aren't rent stabilized. The people
that aren't, that's my point.
The people that are rent stabilized, they're going to start speaking up too, and their buildings become complete shitholes, which is going to start to happen. But everyone else that's accepted these $4,000 a month rents for one bedrooms is just like, oh, that's just the market rent. That's the problem. That shouldn't be the market rent. They need to open up supply to ease the pressure on this huge amount of New Yorkers that are just getting squeezed so hard.
Yeah. or at least, you know, bring back the 421A and then having the housing lottery be a little bit more lenient and raising the income levels as far as the lottery. So the middle market, like the middle income earners can actually, you know, get a decent apartment.
The demand is there. The people want to build. The money is there. It's just all the regulations
and
lack of support for housing that's just getting in the way.
It's true.
Including these rent laws, which is a lack of support.
And the city sucks at it too. Their housing that they control is
the
awful.
NYCHA's the worst landlord in New York City.
Yeah, but yeah. It's like unbelievable.
Yeah.
The whole thing is just so crazy.
Yeah. It's a lot of doom and gloom. Is there any optimism you can give us at the end of this? Is there anything that we can hang our hat on? Is there any light at the end of the tunnel?
I mean, again, I think that eventually, I don't know when that is, but that market forces are going to force the legislature to act. You know, at some point, the problem becomes so big that they don't have a choice. You know, if you have all of these vacant apartments, at some point, something is going to have to give. I don't have any good the only possible good short-term news that we have is that there are still two cases alive before the United States Supreme Court challenging rent stabilization in what's called as-applied challenges. CHIP's lawsuit was dismissed several weeks ago. The court decided that it wasn't going to hear the appeal. But there still are these two cases that could be heard. And if they are heard, I would imagine that given the composition of what the court is now, the court might say some or all of rent stabilization is unconstitutional. But I think that that's a pipe dream, honestly.
Yeah.
I think it's a pipe dream.
They're going to have to make changes. It's only going to be a matter of time. What they did, it's just going to have so many detrimental effects. We're already seeing it. You're starting to see the foreclosures coming in. There's only going to be more of it. And the disrepair these buildings are going to fall into, there's only going to be more of it. This is just the beginning. They're going to have to see the signs of what's going on.
And it affects a whole ecosystem of people. It affects lawyers. It affects brokers. It affects construction workers. You know, empty apartments affect the supermarkets, the bodegas, the restaurants, Ubers. It's just, you know, I don't think people are really whoever's making the policy isn't thinking. It's much more than just owners. It's a whole ecosystem of people that surround owners.
They just wanted to stop tenant harassment. I feel like owners got way too aggressive trying to raise rents on rent stabilized units.
Some.
Yeah, I think the industry as a whole, there's a lot of dislocation. There's a lot of, people moving to these neighborhoods and tenants kind of getting bought out or forced out and renovation of units. And I think they just didn't want that happening so quickly.
I mean, all the gentrification. Someone put it really, I don't want to get too much into politics, but someone one time made a really, interesting point to me was how it all, if you look back and how this all turned out, whether you're on the left or the right, it doesn't matter. You know, Donald Trump coming into office was polarizing in a sense, and it caused this domino effect of politicians like Julia Salazar, AOC getting elected. And these are the type of politicians who are super on the left, super anti-Trump, that end up coming up with these policies.
It caused people to
go
further
left. I'm not just solely blaming it on
I think a lot of people agree with that.
Donald Trump getting elected, but it's just kind of...
He was a catalyst for what happened, I think, in New York City.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whether you like him or not, I mean, I think that's a fact. He was a catalyst for the rise of the far left. And the far left has given us a lot of these really terrible laws.
Well, I think we could probably leave it there. I really appreciate you coming in and giving
us the
education.
Thank you for having me. Thank you, guys.
On the amendments.
Thank you, Justin.
And the Senate bill and all the stuff that goes in there.
That was great.
I'm not sure who's left listening. I'm sure there's still
maybe
people.
Not so great if you own a rent stabilized building.
We'll make sure to put your information in on the podcast and the show notes. And for anyone that has DHCR questions or landlord tenant questions or just nitty gritty stuff,
anything, anybody can call me anytime.
To Alexander Fotopoulos, Court Camellus and Fotopoulos.
You did it. You did
it. All right. Perfect. That was really great.
Thank you.
Really appreciate your perspective on all that.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much.